Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hey there. On last week's show, we aired a conversation with the directors of the new Netflix documentary miniseries, Wild Wild Country. We had to cut it way down to fit into the radio show, but here in the podosphere, we're pretty much unrestricted by the constraints of time and space. So here's that interview again, only much, much more of it. When the six-part documentary series Wild Wild Country came out on Netflix last month, it was like a blast from an unremembered past.
I'm here in one of the largest ranches in the Northwest. Today, it's Rajneesh Burham because a prominent Indian guru and his followers bought it.
Back in the early 80s, thousands of followers of the Indian guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh descended on an Oregon ranch the size of Tallahassee, Florida, to found their utopia. The Rajneeshis had millions of dollars and a lifestyle based on meditation, consciousness raising, and free love. It was all irresistible to their young American and European followers, and increasingly alarming to their closest neighbors in the tiny town of Antelope, population 40. What followed was an epic struggle between the Rajneeshis and every level of government. That struggle involved elections, a relentless media campaign, arson, a mass poisoning, political assassination attempts, and the recruitment of more than 5,000 homeless people from around the country. McLean and Chapman Way directed Wild Wild Country. Hey, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having us. We're excited.
Thanks for having
to talk.
Us on, Bob.
This is a wild, wild story. A quirky religious movement gets pushed out of India and buys a $6 million Oregon ranch to accommodate its peaceful, perfect society. They build their own streets, waterworks, public transportation, shopping centers, houses, police force, even an airstrip, and pretty soon have the attention of the entire world. And they really like the color red. Who were these people?
Yeah, so this is Chapman speaking. A very controversial Indian guru named Bhagwan Rajneesh, who was really one of the first gurus to kind of blend Western capitalism with Eastern mysticism in the 60s. And Europeans and Americans started flocking to his ashram in Pune, India. And a lot of these followers were really highly successful, highly intelligent Westerners who had kind of reached the pinnacle of their careers, and success didn't give them the fulfillment and contentment that they thought it would. And they set out on this path of seeking, and Bhagwan was their path towards enlightenment.
This is McLean speaking. I was just kind of aghast that I had never heard of this story. But then I think when we went back and started kind of really diving in, and the first step was just digitizing all the archive footage.
And by the way, there was a lot of it. I mean, it was the documentarian's dream, no?
Yeah, it was incredible. Back in the early 80s, as news stations were switching off from 16mm film to tape, one of the big pluses of tapes was that you could tape over it. So at the end of your day, you could tape over your tape and you'd save a dollar or two because you could keep reusing those tapes. Luckily, news directors in the Portland area, I think they knew what a significant historical story the Rajneeshis were and the story of Rajneesh Burham. So they kept all their raw U-matic tapes, which was incredibly rare. We weren't just working with what ended up on the nightly news every night. We were working with what the cameramen who drove down to the ranch shot with. And that ended up being, for those 525 raw U-matic tapes, we ended up with over 300 hours of archive footage. And then the group themselves, the Rajneeshis, they were literally on the cutting edge of videotape technology. They were unbelievable cinematographers themselves, and they would edit these ranch promo documentaries, 10 to 15 minutes long, that had survived, that we had gotten access to, too. So we literally almost had footage for everything we wanted to tell.
There are a lot of characters in this story. There's the Bhagwan himself in flowing robes.
Without spirituality, there will be no center. Man is falling apart.
There's his secretary, kind of a chief of staff and spokeswoman, a tiny and very feisty young woman named Ma Anand Sheela.
Bhagwan told me to be very, very strong in the media. I had to be provocative.
There were a few extraordinarily eloquent followers who you spent hours interviewing.
There were little groups of people in orange sitting around or standing around talking quietly to each other. It was a real oasis.
Some nearly as eloquent local town folk in Antelope.
We wondered, you know, who these people are. Why are they here?
Some really determined politicians and prosecutors.
We had no idea that we were going to run into the largest poisoning case in the history of the United States.
It's often very difficult to identify the protagonists. That, I assume, is not an accident.
This is Chapman speaking. We were really interested in giving a platform to our characters to talk about their journey, their experience, and remove us from the equation a little bit. Whether it's through editing or through music or through archive footage, we're really trying to support their journeys and keep the audience in the moment as if the story is unfolding in real time, back like it did in 1981. It was really important for us to get like different points of view within the Rajneesh community and outside the Rajneesh community, but we try not to get too far ahead of our audience as far as telling you, you know, who are the antagonists, who are the protagonists. That's something that's going to unfold as the six episodes play out.
One of the things that we are really, really excited about in doing the story of Rajneesh Perm and making Wild Wild Country as a, you know, multi-part documentary series and kind of playing with that bigger canvas was kind of this idea that you have a lot of room to include vastly different perspectives of the same event.
Oregon Rashomon.
Yeah, exactly. We were exhilarated kind of as filmmakers by this idea that most of our audience are going to come to the story with little familiarity with the story. And probably at one point in the documentary series, they're going to start leaning on maybe one person's perspective or one side's perspective. But hopefully 10, 15 minutes later, as you're hearing new information, hopefully then you're questioning the position you just took. And I think we are interested in doing that, not just for the sake of being objective, although that's nice, but we actually thought that was an entertaining kind of way to structure the series, which is as audience members working their way through the series, doing kind of detective work, not in terms of so much like whodunit, but detective work in, well, where do I draw the line on who's good and bad in the story? And what is the difference between cult and religion, and where do I determine the difference, like my moral compass on the difference between right and wrong?
And to that point, in the first couple of episodes, you kind of invite us to see the Antelopians, the townspeople, as small-minded bigots.
It's new to me. I don't know nothing about it. I just worry about the unknown.
They're strangers to us, and their mode of living is different than we're accustomed to.
We're really not ready for them. Because it's been a sleepy little town, retirement town, and too much activity.
Now, if peaceful coexistence between Rajneesh Purim and Antelope was the original goal for everybody, it sure didn't last long.
The Rajneesh have taken over. They'll make the state red if somebody doesn't do something to stop them.
Which triggered most of the craziness that was to follow.
This is Chapman speaking. When we started doing research, we found that like the first real kind of line that was drawn in the sand between these two groups was this really specific battle over land use. You know, they didn't know this, but other than Hawaii, Oregon had the most strict land use laws in the country. And the plot of land that they bought, the Big Muddy Ranch that was 64,000 acres, was zoned for exclusive farm use only, which limited like what kind of buildings you could have on there, how many houses you could have on the property. And so very early on, the co-founder of Nike, Bill Bowerman, who shared a property line with this commune, starts putting together this legal defense with an environmental group in Oregon called Thousand Friends of Oregon to basically try and go in and dismantle the city by saying, you've broken our land use laws in Oregon. And for this group who had just spent $125 million building their utopia, they saw this as a direct threat to demolish their city. And so at that point, they saw it as an act of survival to go into the closest town to them, which was Antelope, which was 19 miles away, and buy up all the for sale property, move in their own followers to their community, and then they would therefore be able to take over political control of the town, which would allow them incorporation rights, which would allow them to build their businesses, would allow them to have their church there in town. And so they moved over 60 followers into this very conservative cowboy ranching town of Antelope and basically took it over.
Now, the property purchases were legal, above market prices, actually, and the elections were above board. It may have been a sort of bullying, but it was democratic bullying, right?
Yeah. Another reason why Rajneeshis needed to move into Antelope was because their own ranch land wasn't incorporated as a city, although they were trying to do that. And you can have business permits in unincorporated land in Oregon. That's state law. So if they wanted to sell books, specifically Bhagwan's books and discourses, which was kind of a lifeline to them for making money, they needed to set up shop and have a little shipping center in Antelope. One of the interesting parallels that we found in the series was actually, on first glance, the cultural divide between these groups is so vast, but there was some interesting parallels of Antelope was a very religious town that had transformed their barren wasteland into their little city, and they had a church right in the middle of town, and they had a school that was a public school, but it certainly had prayer in public school and things like that, and these are by and large frontier townsfolk that aren't looking for handouts or anything. They're the pull yourself up by your bootstraps type people. And in some ways, I think the Rajneeshis wanted their own kind of utopian city with their church right in the middle of it and wanted to practice their way of life.
Yeah, and this is Chapman speaking. I think this Antelope takeover draws a lot of interesting parallels for how the people of Antelope took over the land from the Native Americans hundreds of years earlier. And a lot of the Antelopians are very proud of the fact that they come from quote unquote pioneer stock. But, you know, at one point they were an outside group. And so it was really interesting to see that history repeat itself in 1981 with this outside group of foreigners and Americans moving into the American West and trying to build their own town.
Your story is filled with this kind of parallel and paradox. For example, the power play that the Rajneeshis pulled to take power in Antelope didn't really comport with the Bhagwan's message of spirituality very much. And it seems to me that throughout the film, you guys are toying with cognitive dissonance. Pretty early on, we are wondering, wait, is this a utopia or is it a racket? Are the Antelopians and the Rajneeshis opposites or are they the same? Is this an enlightened community or is it just a sex cult?
Rajneesh is, biblically speaking, an antichrist that the Christian church should be aware of and prepared to answer.
A lot of their spiritual beliefs were based on meditation and peace and free love. But the tools that they use to achieve that can be very brutal, and they use whatever tools they have available to them to accomplish this.
Another place we see competing narratives is the question of religious liberty. Once the Rajneeshis did amass political power in Antelope, they were in a position to use local institutions, the schools, the police, whatever, in service of their community. And the Antelopians, therefore, argued that the Rajneeshis were violating the separation of church and state.
The school is permeated with religious symbolism. It did not look, sound, or feel like a public school.
And, you know, you hear that and you go, well, you know, that's actually kind of a legitimate point. But then you hear the Bhagwan's lawyer point out that that problem doesn't seem to apply to Mormons in Utah or Catholics in Boston.
You know, most Americans are familiar with the separation of church and state, but they're mostly familiar with it from the angle of, look, this is meant to keep religion out of government. The more complex thing is that it's actually a two-sided coin. It's not only just to keep religion out of government, it's also to prevent government intrusion on religious rights. And so Antelope and the local Oregonians and the government see this as a tool to get rid of this group and get rid of this guru. You know, if we file this separation of church-state lawsuit, it'll deem the city illegal and they won't be allowed to exist out there. You get to hear their argument, and it is a very convincing argument that they give. They have a public school, but all the teachers dress in religious garb. They teach the religious teachings of their guru. Is that really a public school? And by being an incorporated city, it gave them their own police force and access to police database information that should be protected. You know, they have this very convincing argument that this religious group is violating the separation of church and state. But then you kind of get to flip the coin and you get to see it from the perspective inside this religious community, which is they feel that this is a complete government intrusion on their rights to assembly, their rights to freedom of religion. And hearing these two sides of the same coin forces the audience to do some critical thinking, and they have to see for themselves where they fall on this issue.
This was kind of a move that the state attorney general, Dave Frohnmayer, takes, which is, it's one thing to fight the Rajneeshis on state land use laws, but this new kind of legal attack on the community, you know, it really strikes to the heart of the community, and the backbone in which this lawsuit is based off is the United States Constitution, which we found fascinating because, you know, in episode one, Sheila will tell the audience, and certainly what she told us was she went to Montclair State University in New Jersey, so she had some experience in America, and she was always in love with the United States Constitution, especially because of its religious freedom protections. And I think that was a big reason why she felt America would be a great fit for Bhagwan, and for that to turn on her, and for her to see that the U.S. Constitution was now being used to strike at the heart of her community. That's when you really start to see things kind of ramp up, not just legal tensions, but it starts to spill over into physical violence.
As filmmakers, we were less interested in confirming this is evil and more interested in exploring the devastation that can occur with ultimate devotion to one man and what can happen with tribalism. And I think that our series starts to show what happens when a power group can manipulate one's devotion into doing things that they shouldn't do.
One man or one woman. I mean, if there's a plain villain to emerge in this series, I suppose it's Ma Anand Sheila, this kind of charmingly pugnacious young woman turns sinister, to say the least. You know, she's got a little Iago, a little Rasputin, a little Cardinal Richelieu. And at one point, when she doesn't have enough votes to dominate a county election, she hatches a crazy scheme.
In Washington, D.C., the Rajneeshis continue to recruit street people with the promise of food and shelter and a free bus ride to Oregon.
The homeless continue to pour into Rajneesh Param.
Continue to pour into Oregon. A spokesperson at Rancho Rajneesh says five more buses.
Yeah, so by episode three, after this group has taken over the town of Antelope, they now set their sights on taking over the larger surrounding county called Wasco County. And it was about 12,000 voting citizens in Wasco County. And so Sheila hatches this plan. They know that they don't have enough people inside the commune to win these Wasco County elections, so they need to bolster their voting numbers. And they hatch this plan to bus in over 5,000 homeless people from the streets from all over America, Washington, D.C., Miami, Skid Row in Los Angeles, San Diego, and they send out Greyhound buses to round up all of these homeless people and bring them inside their commune. You know, Sheila had done her research and knew that Oregon had the most liberal voting rights in the country. You only needed to live in Oregon for 21 days for the right to register to vote as an Oregonian. So about 2 months before the election, these busloads of homeless people start filing into the commune, and you can really see things slowly start to go off the rails with this plan that she's come up with.
Yeah, it doesn't work out that well. Spoiler alert,
It was bananas. She brought in voters, but she also brought in mental health issues, alcoholism, some criminality. And I think the moral is utopia works way better when it's like a country club and you can blackball the people who you don't want in your utopia.
This was an interesting time where there was a Supreme Court case and a change in policy in the Reagan administration, kind of what redefined homeless and mental illness and who can be held in institutions. So when this plan is hatched to send buses out to major metropolitan areas to recruit homeless people, obviously a ton of mental illness is getting invited to come live on the ranch. And the other interesting dynamic that had emerged in our archive footage was a lot of these homeless people, they were Vietnam War veterans. And so in their own words, in their own interviews from the 80s, they would oftentimes talk about the resentment that they felt towards America and how they felt that, you know, these people dressed in red, they didn't know anything about them, but they were the first people that were offering them a helping hand with free food, shelter, a community that is, you know, by and large, at least initially accepting of you. I think for the exchange for you to register to vote, it was like no big deal. They loved it. They kind of were interested in voting and supporting this community. It's has to be called exploitative, I would imagine. You know, the nicest way to put it would say it's quid pro quo between, you know, the Rajneeshis and these homeless people. Yeah, suffice to say, it obviously doesn't work out that well. Jane, who is kind of one of our Rajneeshis, and she was a key interview for us because we really wanted to capture a Rajneeshi that was starting to break away from the movement. And, you know, what Jane would often talk about was, it was called the Share a Home program, busing in thousands of homeless people. And she would often call this the kind of beginning of the end of Rajneeshpuram.
It was a catastrophe. We had literally thousands of homeless people causing complete chaos. It became clear that we had a hornet's nest right in the middle of the community.
And I think for someone like her, she was still holding on to peace, yoga, meditation, utopian ideal. To see overnight almost, it goes, there's a 2-to-1 ratio of homeless people to Rajneeshis. I think that it was beginning to open her eyes up that this isn't what we started here.
You mentioned Jane. Through all of this bizarre stuff that plays out episode by episode, you continue to serve us threads of testimony from Rajneeshis past and present. Memories that create some doubt about who was responsible for which outrage. And in some cases seems particularly exculpatory for the Bhagwan himself, pointing blame away from him and towards Sheila. After 6 hours of this, really, we still don't know, as viewers, whether Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh was a holy man whose teachings were perverted by opportunists, or a crook from the get-go.
Arming themselves with guns and the political assassination attempts, you know, was this the work of Sheila, or was she just doing what the Bhagwan told her to do? And, you know, we did a ton of research. We filed Freedom of Information Act with the government that had recordings and conversations between the two. And the government is refusing to release these tapes that were confiscated on the ranch because the subjects in the recordings were not aware that they were being recorded at the time under a wiretap. So they refused to release these tapes, which I believe probably holds a lot of information on really what was going on between the guru and Sheila. But we did talk to federal officials, and what they told us was, look, it didn't seem like they had a lot of evidence linking the guru to these more outlandish crimes. The one thing that they could kind of get the guru on were these fraudulent marriages to obtain visas and green cards. And so that's really what the government goes after the Bhagwan on criminally to try and get him out of the country. As far as, you know, was it Sheila or the Bhagwan? I think those two characters are the only people that truly know. And from Sheila's perspective, she feels like my job was to fall on the sword and take the blame. And that's what I did. I went to prison. I didn't rat anyone out. I didn't give up any information on the Bhagwan. And I did my job well as the secretary.
Yeah. And just to kind of elaborate on that, we talked to federal prosecutors. And I think one of the reasons that they said that they didn't have that much evidence linking Bhagwan to the more egregious criminal acts was because they were highly, highly criticized after this story happened about the fact that Sheila went to jail. Jane Stork, she went to jail. A woman named Manan Pooja went to jail. The first mayor of Rajneeshpuram, David Knapp, went to jail. A lot of these people served prison sentences, but Bhagwan just got to pay $500,000 and leave the country. And federal prosecutors were roasted for that by the Oregon press, by Oregonians, who, especially for a lot of people who felt that Bhagwan was at the top of this organization. And if anyone should spend some time in jail, it should be him. But they were just very transparent in the sense that they said we would not have been able to secure a sentence like that. We had no evidence linking him to kind of some of the more egregious criminal activity on the ranch.
Putting aside the question of individual culpability, the series brings up fundamental questions about the very nature of would-be utopian societies. Let's just assume for a second that the intention of all of the Rajneeshis was entirely pure. Let's assume that they were just good people who wanted to do something radical and utopian and truly alive in their short time on this earth. And along the way, they encountered hostile land use regulations, inconvenient laws, unhappy neighbors, all of the realities of society. And furthermore, even without the outside world, Rajneeshpuram couldn't even bear the weight of its own internal contradictions. What does this story tell us about the possibility for any utopian project to gain purchase in the modern world filled with other people?
One of the questions that we would ask ourselves, and we've been asked it, and it's been something that's talked about, is what if the Rajneeshis were just kind of left alone? Would it still be out there? Would they have survived? And one of the conversations that we are consistently having is kind of this idea of, you know, the innate human reactions that people in this story had. You know, I think it's actually natural that these Antelopians were scared of these Rajneeshis that came into their town and dressed head to toe in one color and maybe armed themselves with AK-47s. I think that's like a natural fear that you have. But then, like, what do you do after that? That's what you're in control of. And the same goes for the Rajneeshis. It's like the anger that they must have felt when they feel like their community is being threatened over land use, something that they felt that they had transformed this wasteland into this utopian oasis, and then land use and environmentalism to kind of come and strike a chord to it, must have caused an immense amount of rage and anger. But it's what you do after that. And so it's a really complicated type of answer or to the question. But in some ways, I think that Sheila's innate personality, Bhagwan's innate philosophy was provocation, was controversy. And I think that instead of moving towards compromise or conflict resolution, the Rajneeshis, when push came to shove, they certainly shoved harder than anyone else. And I think that that was either a combination of just the personalities of the leaders in the ranch or a little bit of the movement's kind of modus operandi was that, you know, we don't turn the other cheek. When our cheek gets hit, we take both of your cheeks. And I think obviously on the Antelopians, it was kind of the same sort of thing. You know, they did not want these Rajneeshis to be their forever neighbors. And I think that they were going to do whatever it took to kind of get them out of town.
One final question. This is on the media, and a hammer thinks everything is a nail. But I contend that this episode in the 80s in Oregon is at the core a media story. From the outset, the Bhagwan captivated the media. Sheila mastered the media with her smile and her bluntness and her seeming never-ending press tour.
No, I'm not running for cover, mister. I don't run for cover. And a person like you make me run for cover? Ah, that's a joke.
Video, as we discussed, was used as a defensive weapon by the Rajneeshis and as an intimidation tool as well. When the story got really hairy, newsrooms worldwide followed every development. It was kind of a proto-OJ. Without mass media, does the Rajneeshi movement even ever happen?
I think that this story does show all the implications of how media was used. And I think that the Rajneeshis believe that all media is good media, whether it's negative, whether it's controversial. Anytime people are talking about us, we're selling more books, more people are hearing our name, we're growing. Let's be provocative, let's be challenging. And it's really interesting seeing in today's political climate how, you know, that's been used now 35 years later. You know, with the Trump organization, I think, is a big believer in all press is good press, you know, whether it's negative or positive. And so really, it was interesting to see how far ahead of the time they were. I think another thing that's really interesting about media is also now today the advent of social media. McLean and I have asked ourselves a lot, how would this story have been different with Twitter, with Facebook? And I think it would have been really interesting today to see how today's liberal audience would have interpreted this story of this quote-unquote persecution of this religious minority group, and what kind of support would they have gotten, and what kind of protection through social media would they have received. I think it's just a really fascinating story on how groups can use media to manipulate and also as a weapon and also as a shield.
And yet so ephemeral, so evanescent. I mean, where did it go?
Yeah.
For 35 years, 70 Rolls Royces, poisonings. How did it evaporate till now?
Yeah, it was one of those things where, I mean, even just to, without that archive footage and without that media coverage, I don't think Wild Wild Country as a documentary series is possible, just because seeing is believing in Wild Wild Country. If you don't see it, I don't know if audiences would really believe it if they were just talking head interviews and being told about it. But yeah, it was absolutely remarkable, the media frenzy that the Rajneeshis created within Oregon and eventually within the United States. I mean, they rocked the state of Oregon for the 5 years that they were there, got acres of print coverage, thousands of feet of film, and hundreds of media tapes that we were able to get access to. But yeah, one of our interviewees, it was not in the series, but he was a deputy attorney general for the state of Oregon. He just said, like, one day it all disappeared. And he's like, the thing that I'm thinking about right now as I'm talking to you guys is, did this really all happen in 5 years? And does really no one remember it? It's almost like a weird, vivid fever dream that he had. But it was just one of those stories that, for I think a variety of reasons, it just kind of disappeared and people didn't really remember it, which I think a big reason why Wild Wild Country has been such a pervasive, kind of talked about documentary series is with social media. People are for the first time talking about their experiences on the ranch. We've seen an explosion of writing and material on Rajneesh Perm since Wild Wild Country has come out. We're today living in a new age, and I think that it's just it's been fascinating to watch.
When we were making this series, everyone was kind of familiar with Jonestown, and everyone was kind of familiar with Waco, and you know, people would constantly ask us, like, how do I not remember this story, or how do I not know about this story? And really, I think it was kind of a combination of factors. I think one, the fact that no one did die in the story, which is remarkable considering the tension out there. But when you look at like the death toll of Jonestown and Waco, there was no bloodshed in this story, which is why I think it kind of got lost to the dustbins of history. The other interesting thing is, when we went through a lot of the media in the 80s, this story really was reported as just kind of this bizarre, quirky thing that was happening out in Eastern Oregon with this guy and these Rolls Royces. And no one was really diving into the underbelly and the complexities of this story and what makes it so fascinating and so rich. And so I think by the time the commune disbanded in 1985, everyone was like, oh, that weird, quirky experiment is over. But I think what documentary allows you to do is it allows you to kind of shine a light on these forgotten stories and re-examine what makes them so profound and what makes them so significant.
Chapman and McLean, thank you very much.
Thank Great you so talking much. You. Thanks for having us on.
Chapman and McLean Way are brothers and directors of Wild Wild Country, available on Netflix. Thanks for listening to this week's Pod Extra. And before you go, I have a special request. First, look around you. You probably don't even notice it, but you are surrounded on the streets, on buildings, bridges, the parks, everywhere, names. Who exactly were these people that we've chosen to memorialize? What were their stories? For instance, visitors to WNYC in Lower Manhattan might unknowingly pass by King Street, named after Rufus King, an abolitionist, and Houston Street, named after William Houston, a slave owner, just one block apart. We want to hear about the names around you. Not just the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts, but also the Smiths, the Clarks, the Garfields. We want to know who they were and especially whether you'd still choose to memorialize them today. Yes, residents of Diablo, California, Manson, Washington, and Idiotville, Oregon, we're talking to you. To let us know what you found, just go to onthemedia.org/names and record a message for us. Tell us your name and where you are and what you've learned about a name near you. And we might even use your recording for a future show. Happy name hunting.